If the poor fellow has travelled this far, we shall see him. Send him in, Herringbone. The chief adviser was delighted at this further evidence of a new, kind and considerate king, and hurried off to the double doors to tell the guards to let the shepherd inside. The king settled himself back on his throne, and Spittleworth and Flapoon sat back down on their chairs, their expressions sour. The old man, who now tottered up the long red carpet towards the throne, was very weather-beaten and rather dirty, with a straggly beard and ragged, patched clothes. He snatched off his cap as he approached the king, looking thoroughly frightened, and when he reached the place where people usually bowed or curtsied, he fell to his knees instead.
"Your Majesty!" he wheezed.
"Your Majesty," Spittleworth imitated him softly, making the old shepherd sound like a sheep. Flapoon's chins trembled with silent laughter.
"Your Majesty," continued the shepherd, "I have travelled for 5 long days for to see ye. It has been a hard journey. I has ridden in hayricks when I could, and walked when I couldn't, and my boots is all holes."
"Oh, get on with it, do," muttered Spittleworth, his long nose still buried in his handkerchief.
"But all the time I was travelling, I thought of old Patch, sire, and how ye'd help me if I could but reach the palace."
"What is old Patch, good fellow?" asked the king, his eyes upon the shepherd's much-darned trousers.
"'Tis my old dog, sire, or was, I should perhaps say," replied the shepherd, his eyes filling with tears.
"Ah," said King Fred, fumbling with the money purse at his belt.
"Then, good shepherd, take these few gold coins and buy yourself a new—" "Nay, sire, thank ye. But it bain't a question of the gold," said the shepherd. "I can find myself a puppy easy enough, though it'll never match old Patch."
The shepherd wiped his nose on his sleeve. Spittleworth shuddered.
"Well then, why have you come to me?" asked King Fred, as kindly as he knew how. "To tell ye, sire, how Patch met his end."
"Ah," said King Fred, his eyes wandering to the golden clock on the mantelpiece.
"Well, we'd love to hear the story, but we are rather wanting our lunch." "'Twas the Ichabog that ate him, sire," said the shepherd.
There was an astonished silence, and then Spittleworth and Flapoon burst out laughing. The shepherd's eyes overflowed with tears, which fell sparkling onto the red carpet.
"Ah, they've laughed at me from Jeroboam to Shoeville, sire, when I've told them why I was coming to see ye. Laughed themselves silly, they have, and told me I was daft in the head. But I seen the monster with me own 2 eyes, and so did poor Patch afore he was et."
King Fred felt a strong urge to laugh along with the 2 lords. He wanted his lunch, and he wanted to get rid of the old shepherd, but at the same time that horrid little voice was whispering "selfish, vain and cruel" inside his head.
"Why don't you tell me what happened?" King Fred said to the shepherd,
and Spittleworth and Flapoon stopped laughing at once.
"Well, sire," said the shepherd, wiping his nose on his sleeve again, "'twas twilight and right foggy, and Patch and me was walking home round the edge of the marsh. Patch sees a marsh teasel."
"Sees a what?" asked King Fred.
"A marsh teasel, sire. Them's bald, rat-like things what lives in the marsh. Not bad in pies, if you don't mind the tails."
Flapoon looked queasy.
"So Patch sees the marsh teasel," the shepherd continued, "and he gives chase. I shouts for Patch and shouts, sire, but he was too busy to come back. And then, sire, I hears a yelp. "Patch!" I cries. "Patch, what's got ye, lad?" But Patch don't come back, sire. And then I sees it through the fog,
said the shepherd in a low voice.
Huge it is, with eyes like lanterns, and a mouth as wide as that there throne, and its wicked teeth shining at me. And I forgets old Patch, sire, and I runs and runs and runs all the way home. And next day I sets off, sire, to come and see ye. The Ichabod ate me dog, sire, and I wants it punished.
The king looked down at the shepherd for a few seconds. Then, very slowly, he got to his feet. "Shepherd," said the king, "we shall travel north this very day to investigate the matter of the Ichabod once and for all. If any trace of the creature can be found, you may rest assured that it shall be tracked to its lair and punished for its impudence in taking your dog. Now, take these few gold coins and hire yourself a ride back home in a haycart." "My lords," said the king, turning to the stunned Spittleworth and Flapoon, "pray change into your riding gear and follow me to the stables. There is a new hunt afoot." Chapter 10. King Fred's Quest. King Fred strode from the throne room feeling quite delighted with himself. Nobody would ever again say that he was selfish, vain, and cruel. For the sake of a smelly, simple old shepherd and his worthless old mongrel, he, King Fred the Fearless, was going to hunt the Ichabod. True, there was no such thing, but it was still dashed fine and noble of him to ride to the other end of the country in person to prove it. Quite forgetting lunch, the king rushed upstairs to his bedroom, shouting for his valet to come and help him out of the dreary black suit and help him into his battle dress, which he'd never had the chance to wear before. The tunic was scarlet, with buttons of gold, a purple sash, and lots of medals that Fred was allowed to wear because he was king. And when Fred looked in the mirror and saw how well battle dress became him, he wondered why he didn't wear it all the time. As his valet lowered the king's plumed helmet onto his golden curls, Fred imagined himself painted wearing it, seated on his favourite milk-white charger and spearing a serpent-like monster with his lance. King Fred the Fearless, indeed! Why, he half hoped there really was an Ichabod now. Meanwhile, the chief adviser was sending word throughout the city within the city that the king was setting off on a tour of the country and that everyone should be ready to cheer him as he left. Herringbone made no mention of the Ichabod because he wanted to prevent the king from looking foolish if he could. Unfortunately, the footman called Cankerby had overheard two advisers muttering together about the king's strange scheme. Cankerby immediately told the between maid, who spread the word all over the kitchens, where a sausage seller from Barrenstown was gossiping with the cook. In short, by the time the king's party was ready to leave, word had spread all through the city within the city that the king was riding north to hunt the Ichabod, and news was also beginning to leak out into wider Shoeville. "Is it a joke?" the capital's inhabitants asked each other as they thronged out onto the pavements, ready to cheer the king. "What does it mean?" Some shrugged and laughed and said that the king was merely having fun. Others shook their heads and muttered that there must be more to it than that. No king would ride out armed to the north of the country without good reason. "What," the worried folk asked each other, "does the king know that we do not?" Lady Eslander joined the other ladies of the court on a balcony to watch the soldiers assembling. I shall now tell you a secret which nobody else knew. Lady Eslander would never have married the king, even if he had asked her. You see, she was secretly in love with a man called Captain Goodfellow, who was now chatting and laughing with his good friend Major Beamish in the courtyard below. Lady Eslander, who was very shy, had never been able to bring herself to talk to Captain Goodfellow, who had no idea that the most beautiful woman at court was in love with him. Both Goodfellow's parents, who were dead, had been cheesemakers from Kurdsberg. Though Goodfellow was both clever and brave, these were the days when no cheesemaker's son would expect to marry a high-born lady. Meanwhile, all the servants' children were being let out of school early to watch the battle party set off. Mrs. Beamish, the pastry chef, naturally rushed to collect Bert so that he'd have a good spot to watch his father passing by. When the palace gates opened at last and the cavalcade rode out, Bert and Mrs. Beamish cheered at the top of their lungs. Nobody had seen battle dress for a very long time. How exciting it was, and how fine! The sunlight played upon the golden buttons, silver swords, and the gleaming trumpets of the buglers, and up on the palace balcony the handkerchiefs of the ladies of the court fluttered in farewell like doves. At the front of the procession rode King Fred on his milk-white charger, holding scarlet reins and waving at the crowds. Right behind him, riding a thin yellow horse and wearing a bored expression, was Spittleworth. And next came Flapoon, furiously lunchless and sitting on his elephantine chestnut. Behind the king and the two lords trotted the royal guard, all of them on dapple-grey horses, except for Major Beamish, who rode his steel-grey stallion. It made Mrs. Beamish's heart flutter to see her husband looking so handsome.
"Good luck, Daddy!"
shouted Bert, and Major Beamish, though he really shouldn't have done, waved at his son. The procession trotted down the hill, smiling at the cheering crowds of the city within the city, until it reached the gates in the wall onto wider Shoeville. There, hidden by the crowds, was the Dovetails' cottage. Mr. Dovetail and Daisy had come out into their garden, and they were just able to see the plumes in the helmets of the royal guard riding past. Daisy didn't feel much interest in the soldiers. She and Bert still weren't talking to each other. In fact, he had spent morning break with Roderick Roach, who often jeered at Daisy for wearing overalls instead of a dress. So the cheering and the sound of the horses didn't raise her spirits at all.
"There isn't really an Ichabod, Daddy, is there?" she asked.
"No, Daisy," sighed Mr. Dovetail, turning back to his workshop. "There's no Ichabod, but if the king wants to believe in it, let him. He can't do much harm up in the marshlands." Which just goes to show that even sensible men may fail to see a terrible, looming danger. Chapter 11. The Journey North. King Fred's spirits rose higher and higher as he rode out of Shoeville and into the countryside. Word of the king's sudden expedition to find the Ichabod had now spread to the farmers who worked the rolling green fields, and they ran with their families to cheer the king, the two lords, and the royal guard as they passed. Not having had any lunch, the king decided to stop in Kurdsberg to eat a late dinner.
"We'll rough it here, chaps, like the soldiers we are," he cried to his party as they entered the city famed for its cheese, "and we'll set out again at first light."
But of course there was no question of the king roughing it. Visitors at Kurdsberg's finest inn were thrown out onto the street to make way for him, so Fred slept that night in a brass bed with a duck-down mattress, after a hearty meal of toasted cheese and chocolate fondue. The lords Spittleworth and Flapoon, on the other hand, were forced to spend the night in a little room over the stables. Both were rather sore after a long day on horseback. You may wonder why that was, if they went hunting 5 times a week. But the truth was that they generally sneaked off to sit behind a tree after half an hour's hunting, where they ate sandwiches and drank wine until it was time to go back to the palace. Neither was used to spending hours in the saddle, and Spittleworth's bony bottom was already starting to blister. Early the following morning, the king was brought word by Major Beamish that the citizens of Baronstown were very upset the king had chosen to sleep in Kurdsberg rather than their splendid city. Eager not to dent his popularity, King Fred instructed his party to ride in an enormous circle through the surrounding fields, being cheered by farmers all the way, so that they ended up in Baronstown by nightfall. The delicious smell of sizzling sausages greeted the royal party, and a delighted crowd carrying torches escorted Fred to the best room in the city. There he was served roasted ox and honey ham, and slept in a carved oak bed with a goose-down mattress, while Spittleworth and Flapoon had to share a tiny attic room, usually occupied by 2 maids. By now, Spittleworth's bottom was extremely painful, and he was furious that he'd been forced to ride 40 miles in a circle purely to keep the sausage makers happy. Flapoon, who'd eaten far too much cheese in Kurdsberg and had consumed 3 beefsteaks in Baronstown, was awake all night, groaning with indigestion. Next day, the king and his men set off again, and this time they headed north, soon passing through vineyards from which eager grape pickers emerged to wave cornucopian flags and receive waves from the jubilant king. Spittleworth was almost crying from pain, in spite of the cushion he'd strapped to his bottom, and Flapoon's belches and moans could be heard even over the clatter of hooves and jingle of bridles. Upon arrival at Jeroboam that evening, they were greeted by trumpets and the entire city singing the national anthem. Fred feasted on sparkling wine and truffles that night before retiring to a silken 4-poster bed with a swan's down mattress. But Spittleworth and Flapoon were forced to share a room over the inn's kitchen with a pair of soldiers. Drunken Jeroboam dwellers were reeling about in the street, celebrating the presence of the king in their city. Spittleworth spent much of the night sitting in a bucket of ice, and Flapoon, who'd drunk far too much red wine, spent the same period being sick in a second bucket in the corner. At dawn next morning, the king and his party set out for the marshlands, after a famous farewell from the citizens of Jeroboam, who saw him on his way with a thunderous popping of corks that made Spittleworth's horse rear and ditch him on the road. Once they'd dusted Spittleworth off and put the cushion back on his bottom, and Fred had stopped laughing, the party proceeded. Soon they'd left Jeroboam behind and could hear only birdsong. For the first time in their entire journey, the sides of the road were empty. Gradually, the lush green land gave way to thin, dry grass, crooked trees, and boulders. "Extraordinary place, isn't it?" the cheerful king shouted back to Spittleworth and Flapoon. "I'm jolly glad to see these marshlands at last, aren't you?" The two lords agreed, but once Fred had turned to face the front again, they made rude gestures and mouthed even ruder names at the back of his head. At last the royal party came across a few people, and how the marshlanders stared! They fell to their knees, like the shepherd in the throne room, and quite forgot to cheer or clap, but gaped, as though they'd never seen anything like the king and the royal guard before, which indeed they hadn't, because while King Fred had visited all the major cities of Cornucopia after his coronation, nobody had thought it worth his while to visit the faraway marshlands. "Simple people, yes, but rather touching, aren't they?" the king called gaily to his men as some ragged children gasped at the magnificent horses. They'd never seen animals so glossy and well-fed in their lives.
"And where are we supposed to stay tonight?" Flapoon muttered to Spittleworth, eyeing the tumble-down stone cottages. "No taverns here."
"Well, there's one comfort at least," Spittleworth whispered back. "He'll have to rough it like the rest of us, and we'll see how much he likes it." They rode on through the afternoon, and at last, as the sun began to sink, they caught sight of the marsh where the Ichabod was supposed to live, a wide stretch of darkness, studded with strange rock formations.
"Your Majesty," called Major Beamish, "I suggest we set up camp now and explore the marsh in the morning. As your Majesty knows, the marsh can be treacherous. Fogs come suddenly here. We'd do best to approach it by daylight."
"Nonsense," said Fred, who was bouncing up and down in his saddle like an excited schoolboy. "We can't stop now when it's in sight, Beamish." The king had given his order, so the party rode on until, at last, when the moon had risen and was sliding in and out behind inky clouds, they reached the edge of the marsh. It was the eeriest place any of them had ever seen, wild and empty and desolate. A chilly breeze made the rushes whisper, but otherwise it was dead and silent.
"As you see, sire," said Lord Spittleworth after a while, "the ground is very boggy. Sheep and men alike would be sucked under if they wandered out too far. Then the feeble-minded might take these giant rocks and boulders for monsters in the dark. The rustling of these weeds might even be taken for the hissing of some creature."
"Yes, true, very true," said King Fred, but his eyes still roamed over the dark marsh, as though he expected the Ichabod to pop up from behind a rock.
"Shall we pitch camp then, sire?" asked Lord Flapoon,
who'd saved some cold pies from Baronstown and was eager for his supper. "We can't expect to find even an imaginary monster in the dark," pointed out Spittleworth.
"True, true," repeated King Fred regretfully. "Let us... Good gracious, how foggy it has become."
And sure enough, as they'd stood looking out across the marsh, a thick white fog had rolled over them so swiftly and silently that none of them had noticed it. Chapter 12. The King's Lost Sword. Within seconds, it was as though each of the king's party was wearing a thick white blindfold. The fog was so dense they couldn't see their own hands in front of their faces. The mist smelled of the foul marsh, of brackish water and ooze. The soft ground seemed to shift beneath their feet as many of the men turned unwisely on the spot. Trying to catch sight of each other, they lost all sense of direction. Each man felt adrift in a blinding white sea, and Major Beamish was one of the few to keep his head.
"Have a care!"
he called. "The ground is treacherous. Stay still. Don't attempt to move." But King Fred, who was suddenly feeling rather scared, paid no attention. He set off at once in what he thought was the direction of Major Beamish, but within a few steps he felt himself sinking into the icy marsh. "Help!" he cried, as the freezing marsh water flooded over the tops of his shining boots. "Help! Beamish, where are you? I'm sinking!" There was an immediate clamour of panicked voices and jangling armour. The guards all hurried off in every direction, trying to find the king, bumping into each other and slipping over. But the floundering king's voice drowned out every other. "I've lost my boots! Why doesn't somebody help me? Where are you all?" The Lords Spittleworth and Flapoon were the only two people who'd followed Beamish's advice and remained quite still in the places they'd occupied when the fog had rolled over them. Spittleworth was clutching a fold of Flapoon's ample pantaloons, and Flapoon was holding tight to the skirt of Spittleworth's riding coat. Neither of them made the smallest attempt to help Fred, but waited, shivering, for calm to be restored. "At least if the fool gets swallowed by the bog, we'll be able to go home," Spittleworth muttered to Flapoon. The confusion deepened. Several of the royal guard had now got stuck in the bog as they tried to find the king. The air was full of squelches, clanks, and shouts. Major Beamish was bellowing in a vain attempt to restore some kind of order, and the king's voice seemed to be receding into the blind night, becoming ever fainter, as though he was blundering away from them. And then, out of the heart of the darkness, came an awful, terror-struck shriek.
"Beamish! Help me! I can see the monster!"
"I'm coming, Your Majesty," cried Major Beamish. "Keep shouting, sire! I'll find you!"
"Help! Help me, Beamish!"
shouted King Fred. "What's happened to the idiot?" Flapoon asked Spittleworth, but before Spittleworth could answer, the fog around the two lords thinned as quickly as it had arrived, so that they stood together in a little clearing, able to see each other, but still surrounded on all sides by high walls of thick white mist. The voices of the king, of Beamish, and of the other soldiers were becoming fainter and fainter. "Don't move yet," Spittleworth cautioned Flapoon. "Once the fog thins a little bit more, we'll be able to find the horses, and we can retreat to a safe—" At that precise moment, a slimy black figure burst out of the wall of fog and launched itself at the two lords. Flapoon let out a high-pitched scream, and Spittleworth lashed out at the creature, missing only because it flopped to the ground, weeping. It was then that Spittleworth realized the gibbering, panting, slime monster was in fact King Fred the Fearless.
"Thank heavens we've found you, Your Majesty. We've been searching everywhere," cried Spittleworth.
"Ick, ick, ick,"
whimpered the king.
"He's got hiccups," said Flapoon. "Give him a fright."
"Ichabog!"
moaned Fred.
I saw it. A gigantic monster. It nearly caught me."
"I beg your majesty's pardon?" asked Spittleworth.
The monster is real," gulped Fred. "I'm lucky to be alive. To the horses! We must flee, and quickly!"
King Fred tried to hoist himself up by climbing Spittleworth's leg, but Spittleworth stepped swiftly aside to avoid getting covered in slime, instead aiming a consoling pat at the top of Fred's head, which was the cleanest part of him. There, Your Majesty. You've had a most distressing experience falling in the marsh. As we were saying earlier, the boulders do indeed assume monstrous forms in this thick fog.
Dash it, Spittleworth, I know what I saw! Shouted the King, staggering to his feet unaided. Tall as two horses it was, and with eyes like huge lamps. I drew my sword, but my hands were so slimy it slipped from my grasp, so there was nothing for it but to pull my feet out of my stuck boots and crawl away.
Just then, a fourth man made his way into their little clearing in the fog. Captain Roach, father of Roderick, who was Major Beamish's second in command, a big, burly man with jet-black moustaches. What Captain Roach was really like, we are about to find out. All you need to know now is that the King was very glad to see him, because he was the largest member of the Royal Guard.
"Did you see any sign of the Ichabod, Roach?" whimpered Fred.
"No, Your Majesty," he said with a respectful bow. "All I've seen is fog and mud. I'm glad to know Your Majesty is safe, at any rate. You gentlemen stay here, and I'll round up the troops."
Roach made to leave, but King Fred yelped.
"No, you stay here with me, Roach, in case the monster comes this way. You've still got a rifle, haven't you? Excellent. I lost my sword and my boots, you see. My very best dress sword with the jewelled hilt."
Though he felt much safer with Captain Roach beside him, the trembling King was otherwise as cold and scared as he could ever remember being. He also had a nasty feeling that nobody believed he'd really seen the Ichabod, a feeling that increased when he caught sight of Spittleworth rolling his eyes at Flapoon. The King's pride was stung.
"Spittleworth, Flapoon," he said, "I want my sword and my boots back. They're over there somewhere," he added, waving his arm at the encircling fog.
Would it not be better to wait until the fog has cleared, Your Majesty?" asked Spittleworth nervously.
"I want my sword," snapped King Fred. "It was my grandfather's, and it's very valuable. Go and find it, both of you. I shall wait here with Captain Roach, and don't come back empty-handed."
Chapter 13. The Accident. The two lords had no choice but to leave the King and Captain Roach in their little clearing in the fog and proceed onto the marsh. Spittleworth took the lead, feeling his way with his feet for the firmest bits of ground. Flapoon followed close behind, still holding tightly to the hem of Spittleworth's coat and sinking deeply with every footstep because he was so heavy. The fog was clammy on their skin and rendered them almost completely blind. In spite of Spittleworth's best efforts, the two lords' boots were soon full to the brim with fetid water.
"That blasted nincompoop," muttered Spittleworth as they squelched along. "That blithering buffoon, this is all his fault, the mouse-brained moron."
"It'll serve him right if that sword's lost for good," said Flapoon, now nearly waist-deep in marsh.
"We'd better hope it isn't, or we'll be here all night," said Spittleworth. "Oh, curse this fog!"
They struggled onwards. The mist would thin for a few steps, then close again. Boulders loomed suddenly out of nowhere like ghostly elephants, and the rustling reed sounded just like snakes. Though Spittleworth and Flapoon knew perfectly well that there was no such thing as an Ichabod, their insides didn't seem quite so sure.
"Let go of me," Spittleworth growled at Flapoon, whose constant tugging was making him think of monstrous claws or jaws fastened on the back of his coat.
Flapoon let go, but he too had been infected by a nonsensical fear, so he loosened his blunderbuss from its holster and held it ready.
"What's that?"
he whispered to Spittleworth as an odd noise reached them out of the darkness ahead. Both lords froze, the better to listen. A low growling and scrabbling was coming out of the fog. It conjured an awful vision in both men's minds of a monster feasting on the body of one of the royal guard.
"Who's there?"
Spittleworth called in a high-pitched voice. Somewhere in the distance, Major Beamish shouted back.
"Is that you, Lord Spittleworth?"
"Yes,"
shouted Spittleworth.
"We can hear something strange, Beamish. Can you?"
It seemed to the two lords that the odd growling and scrabbling grew louder. Then the fog shifted. A monstrous black silhouette with gleaming white eyes was revealed right in front of them, and it emitted a long yowl. With a deafening, crashing boom that seemed to shake the marsh, Flapoon let off his blunderbuss. The startled cries of their fellow men echoed across the hidden landscape, and then, as though Flapoon's shot had frightened it, the fog parted like curtains before the two lords, giving them a clear view of what lay ahead. The moon slid out from behind a cloud at that moment, and they saw a vast granite boulder with a mass of thorny branches at its base. Tangled up in these brambles was a terrified skinny dog, whimpering and scrabbling to free itself, its eyes flashing in the reflected moonlight. A little beyond the giant boulder, face down in the bog, lay Major Beamish.
"What's going on?" shouted several voices out of the fog. "Who fired?"
Neither Spittleworth nor Flapoon answered. Spittleworth waded as quickly as he could towards Major Beamish. A swift examination was enough. The Major was stone dead, shot through the heart by Flapoon in the dark.
My God, what shall we do?"
bleated Flapoon, arriving at Spittleworth's side.
"Quiet," whispered Spittleworth.
He was thinking harder and faster than he'd thought in the whole of his crafty, conniving life. His eyes moved slowly from Flapoon and the gun to the shepherd's trapped dog, to the king's boots and jeweled sword, which he now noticed half buried in the bog just a few feet away from the giant boulder. Spittleworth waded through the marsh to pick up the king's sword and used it to slash apart the brambles imprisoning the dog. Then, giving the poor animal a hearty kick, he sent it yelping away into the fog.
"Listen carefully," murmured Spittleworth, returning to Flapoon.
But before he could explain his plan, another large figure emerged from the fog. Captain Roach.
"The king sent me,"
panted the captain.
"He's terrified. What happened?"
Then Roach saw Major Beamish lying dead on the ground. Spittleworth realized immediately that Roach must be let in on the plan, and that, in fact, he'd be very useful.
"Say nothing, Roach," said Spittleworth, "while I tell you what has happened. The Ichabod has killed our brave Major Beamish. In view of this tragic death, we shall need a new major, and of course that will be you, Roach, for you're second in command. I shall recommend a large pay rise for you because you were so valiant. Listen closely, Roach. So very valiant in chasing after the dreadful Ichabod as it ran away into the fog. You see, the Ichabod was devouring the poor Major's body when Lord Flapoon and I came upon it. Frightened by Lord Flapoon's blunderbuss, which he sensibly discharged into the air, the monster dropped Beamish's body and fled. You bravely gave chase, trying to recover the king's sword,
which was half buried in the monster's thick hide. But you weren't able to recover it, Roach. So sad for the poor king. I believe the priceless sword was his grandfather's, but I suppose it's now lost forever in the Ichabod's lair. So saying, Spittleworth pressed the sword into Roach's large hands. The newly promoted major looked down at its jeweled hilt, and a cruel and crafty smile to match Spittleworth's own spread over his face.
"Yes, a great pity that I wasn't able to recover the sword, my lord," he said, sliding it out of sight beneath his tunic. "Now, let's wrap up the poor major's body, because it would be dreadful for the other men to see the marks of the monster's fangs upon him."
"How sensitive of you, Major Roach," said Lord Spittleworth, and the two men swiftly took off their cloaks and wrapped up the body, while Flapoon watched, heartily relieved that nobody need know he had accidentally killed Beamish.
"Could you remind me what the Ichabod looked like, Lord Spittleworth?" asked Roach, when Major Beamish's body was well hidden. "For the three of us saw it together and will, of course, have received identical impressions."
"Very true," said Lord Spittleworth. "Well, according to the king, the beast is as tall as two horses, with eyes like lamps."
"In fact," said Flapoon, pointing, "it looks a lot like this large boulder with a dog's eyes gleaming at the base." "Tall as two horses with eyes like lamps," repeated Roach. "Very well, my lords. If you'll assist me to put Beamish over my shoulder, I'll carry him to the king, and we can explain how the major met his death."
Chapter 14. Lord Spittleworth's Plan. When the fog cleared at last, it revealed a very different party of men to those who'd arrived at the edge of the marsh an hour earlier. Quite apart from their shock at the sudden death of Major Beamish, a few of the royal guard were confused by the explanation they'd been given. Here were the two lords, the king, and the hastily promoted Major Roach, all swearing that they'd come face to face with a monster that all but the most foolish had dismissed for years as a fairy tale. Could it really be true that beneath the tightly wrapped cloaks, Beamish's body bore the tooth and claw marks of the Ichabod?
"Are you calling me a liar?" Major Roach growled into the face of a young private. "Are you calling the king a liar?" barked Lord Flapoon.
The private didn't dare question the word of the king, so he shook his head. Captain Goodfellow, who'd been a particular friend of Major Beamish's, said nothing. However, there was such an angry and suspicious look on Goodfellow's face that Roach ordered him to go and pitch the tents on the most solid bit of ground he could find and be quick about it, because the dangerous fog might yet return. In spite of the fact that he had a straw mattress and that blankets were taken from the soldiers to ensure his comfort, King Fred had never spent a more unpleasant night. He was tired, dirty, wet, and above all, frightened.
"What if the Ichabod comes looking for us, Spittleworth?"
the king whispered in the dark.
"What if it tracks us by our scent? It's already had a taste of poor Beamish. What if it comes looking for the rest of the body?"
Spittleworth attempted to soothe the king. "Do not fear, Your Majesty. Roach has ordered Captain Goodfellow to keep watch outside your tent. Whoever else gets eaten, you will be the last." It was too dark for the king to see Spittleworth grinning. Far from wanting to reassure the king, Spittleworth hoped to fan the king's fears. His entire plan rested on a king who not only believed in an Ichabod, but who was scared it might leave the marsh to chase him. The following morning, the king's party set off back to Jeroboam. Spittleworth had sent a message ahead to tell the mayor of Jeroboam that there had been a nasty accident at the marsh, so the king didn't want any trumpets or corks greeting him. Thus, when the king's party arrived, the city was silent. Townsfolk, pressing their faces to their windows or peeking around their doors, were shocked to see the king so dirty and miserable, but not nearly as shocked as they were to see a body wrapped in cloaks tied to Major Beamish's steel-grey horse. When they reached the inn, Spittleworth took the landlord aside. "We require some cold, secure place, perhaps a cellar, where we can store a body for the night, and I shall need to keep the key myself."
"What happened, my lord?"
asked the innkeeper, as Roach carried Beamish down the stone steps into the cellar. "I shall tell you the truth, my good man, seeing as you have looked after us so well, but it must go no further," said Spittleworth in a low, serious voice. "The Ichabod is real, and has savagely killed one of our men. You understand, I'm sure, why this must not be widely broadcast. There would be instant panic. The king is returning with all speed to the palace, where he and his advisers, myself of course included, will begin work at once on a set of measures to secure our country's safety."
"The Ichabod? Real?"
said the landlord in astonishment and fear. "Real and vengeful and vicious," said Spittleworth. "But as I say, this must go no further. Widespread alarm will benefit nobody." In fact, widespread alarm was precisely what Spittleworth wanted, because it was essential for the next phase of his plan. Just as he had expected, the landlord waited only until his guests had gone to bed, then rushed to tell his wife, who ran to tell the neighbours, and by the time the king's party set off for Kurdsberg the following morning, they left behind them a city where panic was fermenting as busily as the wine. Spittleworth sent a message ahead to Kurdsberg, warning the cheese-making city not to make a fuss of the king either. So it too was dark and silent when the royal party entered its streets. The faces at the windows were already scared. It so happened that a merchant from Jeroboam, with an especially fast horse, had carried the rumour about the Ichabod to Kurdsberg an hour previously. Once again, Spittleworth requested the use of a cellar for Major Beamish's body, and once again confided to the landlord that the Ichabod had killed one of the king's men. Having seen Beamish's body safely locked up, Spittleworth went upstairs to bed. He was just rubbing ointment into the blisters on his bottom when he received an urgent summons to go and see the king. Smirking, Spittleworth pulled on his pantaloons, winked at Flapoon, who was enjoying a cheese and pickle sandwich, picked up his candle, and proceeded along the corridor to King Fred's room. The king was huddled in bed, wearing his silk nightcap, and as soon as Spittleworth closed the bedroom door, Fred said,
"Spittleworth, I keep hearing whispers about the Ichabod. The stable boys were talking, and even the maid who just passed by my bedroom door. Why is this? How can they know what happened?"
"Alas, your majesty," sighed Spittleworth. "I had hoped to conceal the truth from you until we were safely back at the palace, but I should have known that your majesty is too shrewd to be fooled. Since we left the marsh, sire, the Ichabod has, as your majesty feared, become much more aggressive."
"Oh, no," whimpered the king.
I'm afraid so, sire. But after all, attacking it was bound to make it more dangerous.
But who attacked it? Said Fred.
Why, you did, your majesty, said Spittleworth.
Roach tells me your sword was embedded in the monster's neck when it ran.
I'm sorry, your majesty, did you speak?
The king had, in fact, let out a sort of hum, but after a second or two, he shook his head. He'd considered correcting Spittleworth. He was sure he'd told the story differently, but his horrible experience in the fog sounded much better the way Spittleworth told it now, that he'd stood his ground and fought the Ichabod, rather than simply dropping his sword and running away.
But this is awful, Spittleworth, whispered the king. What will become of us all if the monster has become more ferocious?
Never fear, your majesty, said Spittleworth, approaching the king's bed, the candlelight illuminating his long nose and his cruel smile from below. I intend to make it my life's work to protect you and the kingdom from the Ichabod.
Thank you, Spittleworth. You are a true friend, said the king, deeply moved, and he fumbled to extract a hand from the eiderdown and clasped that of the cunning lord.
Chapter 15. The King Returns. By the time the king set out for Shoeville the following morning, rumours that the Ichabod had killed a man had not only travelled over the bridge into Baronstown, they'd even trickled down to the capital, courtesy of a cluster of cheesemongers who'd set out before dawn. However, Shoeville was not only the furthest away from the northern marsh, it also held itself to be far better informed and educated than the other cornucopian towns, so when the wave of panic reached the capital, it met an upswell of disbelief. The city's taverns and markets rang with excited arguments. Skeptics laughed at the preposterous idea of the Ichabod existing, while others said that people who'd never been to the marshlands ought not to pretend to be experts. The Ichabod rumours had gained a lot of colour as they travelled south. Some people said that the Ichabod had killed 3 men, others that it had merely torn off somebody's nose. In the city within the city, however, discussion was seasoned with a little pinch of anxiety. The wives, children, and friends of the royal guard were worried about the soldiers, but they reassured each other that if any of the men had been killed, their families would have been informed by messenger. This was the comfort that Mrs. Beamish gave Bert when he came looking for her in the palace kitchens, having been scared by the rumours circulating among the schoolchildren.
"The king would have told us if anything had happened to Daddy," she told Bert. "Here now, I've got you a little treat."
Mrs. Beamish had prepared hopes of heaven for the king's return, and she now gave one that wasn't quite symmetrical to Bert. He gasped, because he only ever had hopes of heaven on his birthday, and bit into the little cake. At once his eyes filled with happy tears as paradise wafted up through the roof of his mouth and melted all his cares away. He thought excitedly of his father coming home in his smart uniform and how he, Bert, would be centre of attention at school tomorrow, because he'd know exactly what had happened to the king's men in the faraway marshlands. Dusk was settling over Shoeville when at last the king's party rode into view. This time, Spittleworth hadn't sent a messenger to tell people to stay inside. He wanted the king to feel the full force of Shoeville's panic and fear when they saw His Majesty returning to his palace with the body of one of the royal guard. The people of Shuville saw the drawn, miserable faces of the returning men and watched in silence as the party approached. Then they spotted the wrapped-up body slung over the steel-grey horse, and gasps spread through the crowd like flames. Up through the narrow cobbled streets of Shuville the king's party moved, and men removed their hats and women curtsied, and they hardly knew whether they were paying their respects to the king or the dead man. Daisy Dovetail was one of the first to realize who was missing. Peering between the legs of grown-ups, she recognized Major Beamish's horse. Instantly forgetting that she and Bert hadn't talked to each other since their fight of the previous week, Daisy pulled free of her father's hand and began to run, forcing her way through the crowds, her brown pigtails flying. She had to reach Bert before he saw the body on the horse. She had to warn him. But the people were so tightly packed that fast as Daisy moved, she couldn't keep pace with the horses. Bert and Mrs. Beamish, who were standing outside their cottage in the shadow of the palace walls, knew there was something wrong because of the crowd's gasps. Although Mrs. Beamish felt somewhat anxious, she was still sure that she was about to see her handsome husband, because the king would have sent word if he'd been hurt. So when the procession rounded the corner, Mrs. Beamish's eyes slid from face to face, expecting to see the major's. And when she realized that there were no more faces left, the color drained slowly from her own. Then her gaze fell upon the body strapped to Major Beamish's steel-gray horse, and, still holding Bert's hand, she fainted clean away. Chapter 16. Bert Says Goodbye. Spittleworth noticed a commotion beside the palace walls and strained to see what was going on. When he spotted the woman on the ground and heard the cries of shock and pity, he suddenly realized that he had left a loose end that might yet trip him up. The widow. As he rode past the little knot of people in the crowd who were fanning Mrs. Beamish's face, Spittleworth knew that his longed-for bath must be postponed, and his crafty brain began to race again. Once the king's party was safely in the courtyard, and servants had hurried to assist Fred from his horse, Spittleworth pulled Major Roach aside. "The widow, Beamish's widow," he muttered. "Why didn't you send her word about his death?"
"It never occurred to me, my lord," said Roach truthfully.
He'd been too busy thinking about the jeweled sword all the way home, how best to sell it, and whether it would be better to break it up into pieces so that nobody recognized it.
"Curse you, Roach, must I think of everything?" snarled Spittleworth. "Go now, take Beamish's body out of those filthy cloaks, cover it with a cornucopian flag, and lay him out in the blue parlour. Put guards on the door, and then bring Mrs. Beamish to me in the throne room. Also, give the order that these soldiers must not go home or talk to their families until I've spoken to them. It's essential that we all tell the same story. Now hurry, fool, hurry. Beamish's widow could ruin everything." Spittleworth pushed his way past soldiers and stable boys to where Flapoon was being lifted off his horse. "Keep the king away from the throne room and the blue parlour," Spittleworth whispered in Flapoon's ear. "Encourage him to go to bed.